Hello, and welcome to Close the Door and Come Here, a Game of Thrones and a Song of Ice and Fire podcast with heavy leanings toward our two favorite characters, Jaime and Brienne. Man, there was a bear up there, all black and brown and covered in hair. So this week, we continue our read of Storm of Swords. Actually, we're almost done with Storm of Swords. Today, we're covering two chapters, Jaime 7 and Jaime 8. And as usual, blanket spoiler warnings, spoilers for the show, spoilers for the books. I have a feeling the show may come up this podcast, so that's important. And unfortunately, because I do think the show may come up, we've got to do a trigger warning on this for rape yet again, as is a continuing theme for this podcast, unfortunately. This week, I have two of the usual suspects with me. I have Eon.
Hey, this is Eon, and you can find me at EonBlueNegative on Tumblr.
And YD.
Hi, everyone. This is YD, and you can find me at YellowDelaney on Tumblr.
And we have a returning guest. We have Rose Papillon.
Hello, I'm Rose Papillon, also Erin. You can find me at brienneoftarth.tumblr.com.
Awesome. And we have the lovely Relly for the first time.
Hi, I'm Relly, and you can find me at soverygeeky.tumblr.com.
Awesome. So we're all really excited about this episode, you guys.
Super excited, you guys.
And it's, you know, not because we all want to, like, just skip straight ahead to sex. It's totally not about that.
I've never done not. That. What?
Right? I mean, we're Jaime and Brienne shippers. We must hate the sex, right?
Well.
Oh, shoot. I keep forgetting that. Oh, man. Right.
we're gonna get shipped out of the ship, you guys.
Ejected. Okay, so this chapter opens. Damn it. You know, I really meant to look at the timelines before I started this podcast. I think we're a week or two past where the last chapter ended. Jaime and Brienne are on the road with Steelshanks Walton. They're on their way to King's Landing. I should say back for Jaime, but I think this is a first for Brienne. Jaime's traveling incognito, as we know from the last chapter. He's had his hair shaved for quite a while. He's got a beard now, he's wearing, you know, nondescript clothing, he's carrying some other house's arms, and they stop at an inn the night before they will reach King's Landing, and they get word that Joffrey is dead. And we see one of the more interesting Jaime moments in the books. I don't know what you guys think about this. Opinions vary. But Jaime reacts to hearing that his son is dead, and it's an interesting reaction.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting, I guess. I mean, because he does have that kind of, what is it? It's not a very emotional reaction, is it? It's kind of a...
It's cerebral, for sure.
A very cerebral, calm reaction. So he doesn't really seem particularly upset about Joffrey's death. I don't know. It's difficult to tell with Jaime. I feel like he certainly is having some feelings. I don't know necessarily whether they're specifically about Joffrey being dead. I mean, Jaime knew he was a monster. I don't think he had any strong bond with Joffrey. And I wonder if perhaps he's more upset about the fact that he never really got the opportunity to be Joffrey's father, because he then, you know, later on in the chapter goes on to reflect about how Cersei never let him near him, never even let him hold him as a child. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
It is really difficult
to tell. He seems a little bit more concerned with comforting Cersei.
Because yeah, he is that, very concerned about Cersei. Yeah.
But and I think he does.
Yeah.
No, go ahead, Ian.
He's never been allowed to have a paternal role to any of his children.
Right.
I mean, he's even been less of an uncle, really, since he's been in the Kingsguard, so there's never been that attachment to
his
first
school. That's true, and it's funny that you sort of, in later books, you go on to see Jaime kind of stepping up a little bit in that paternal role with Tommen and Myrcella. But I guess that's discussion for another time.
Right.
I just like to point out at the very start of this chapter, when they're at the inn and they're first getting the news of Joffrey's death, there's about three different accounts of what happened. Because, of course, the news is spread throughout the land, and every time it gets retold, someone adds something else to it or something else changes. And it's kind of like they're using Tumblr as a news source.
Please reblog.
It really is, because the tales are really interesting. Tyrion does have the blame in the stories, but Sansa right along with it.
Yeah, and I think
ghostly direwolf. You know, the idea Sansa disappeared into a puff of smoke and then a ghostly direwolf appears in the Red Keep. Like, that's awesome. I want that to happen.
Yeah.
That's pretty metal.
Yeah, it is. I believe that, Tumblr. Let's go with that. Also, the bat on the shield, I keep imagining Batman.
Anyway. He is Batman. I hope he has Batman's voice.
Oh, yeah.
Jamie is Batman. So because he's worried about Cersei, Jaime insists that they ride harder the next day, and the city's within sight, and they're working really hard to get there. And the whole time, Jaime kind of keeps hitting back on this thing of not feeling enough about losing Joffrey. And it's interesting, he frames his response in that, you know, why am I not feeling anything? And yet he's constantly bothering himself with how much he's not feeling. It's almost like one of those things where a negative might equal a positive just because of how much he's focused on it.
Yeah.
As he continues his journey.
Isn't that a very Jaime thing to do? I mean, you look at the way he treats Brienne and thinks about Brienne and continually tells himself that he's, you know, he's troubled by his response to her. He's not interested. She's ugly. And yet he's continually thinking about her.
Yeah, it is like that. Relly, did you say something?
No, I was just going to say that... Jaime doesn't have a lot of emotional intelligence, I suppose. He doesn't understand his responses to anything, does he?
No, he really doesn't. It is a running theme with him. And it's so funny. Oh, God. I love this. I don't know if you guys love this little passage, but where Jaime talks about when Joffrey was born... He talks about how he was jealous of how much time Joffrey was spending with Cersei's boobs.
Oh, I love that.
Me too.
Such a child.
Well, he was probably a teenager, I guess, when Joffrey was born, but it's still hilarious. Oh my God.
And he's still emotionally a teenager.
He really is.
Yeah. It's actually funny to compare, because you really can compare what's going on here with Jaime, who's just lost his son and yet not sort of outwardly grieving, and then compare that to how Brienne is really, really quite distraught by the death of Catelyn and Rob. Catelyn specifically, I'd presume.
You know, that's it. Jaime is thinking about getting back to Cersei, and he's having these thoughts about, let's replace him with another kid.
Yeah, we can always have another one.
Yeah. Thinking about sex. You know who I should go talk to? Brienne. So he does.
It is quite funny how they fall back into the traditional male and female roles here. Jaime's got the very unemotional reaction, whereas Brienne has the typically feminine reaction of being very upset and everything. I just think that's quite interesting, because people will tend to say that, you know, Brienne's not feminine, whereas she is actually falling back into the traditional feminine role.
That is what's happening, isn't it? And it's also Jaime he wants to slip into the role of comforter as well, because he does talk about how he wants to comfort her. Which is, I guess, a more masculine thing to do as well.
Yeah, she's so upset about the news about the Red Wedding, and he's not sure if it's Robb Stark or if it's Catelyn. I think we'll learn in Feast that it's Catelyn that she's upset about losing. But, yeah, she's so upset, and he does feel an urge to comfort her, and he can't seem to ignore how upset that she is. And he almost seems a little upset that she's so much more upset than he is, like you guys touched on.
Yeah. I think he does. He looks at her and sees the way that she's grieving for, well, he's not sure who, but for people that she never really knew for that long, that she wasn't really that close to in his mind. And I think that gets him wondering as to, why am I not feeling more about my son dying?
Well, it does. And he seems really, I don't know, interested in the fact that it's this that breaks Brienne. After everything that they've been through, it's this, it's the grief that gets to her.
Yeah.
He talks about trying to call her wench just to try to get a response out of her. And then even that doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me that he is so in tune to Brienne's emotions.
He is. And it's funny to see the way that he's behaving around her here, because as I think we touched on before, he starts talking about how he finds her, you know, the least companionable creature he's ever had the misfortune to meet. And yet he keeps going back to her. And isn't that kind of the crux of Jaime's issue with Brienne? He continues to seek out her company, despite telling himself that he's finding it repugnant. He doesn't understand why he wants to be around her. He wants to comfort her.
It's very sweet. He's actually trying very hard to be kind to her.
He is.
And I think she's misinterpreting it as usual. But when he's saying he'll send her back to Tarth if she wants, or he'll find her a place in court, I think she might think he's mocking her slightly, but
yeah.
he seems to think that he's being very genuine. And
yeah, I agree with you.
We get one of Brienne's snarkier lines in response to that.
As lady companion to the queen.
Lest anyone say Brienne has no sense of humor, she does. You just have to get her in the right mood.
Absolutely. Even when she's distraught, she's a little bit snarky. But really, you raise a really good point there. Jaime is being very kind to Brienne in this chapter. You see him sort of biting back some of his more acerbic thoughts, just because he can see how distraught she is. You know, he when they get back to King's Landing, he's particularly kind to her. I think he tells her that, you know, you've kept your vow. It's almost a thank you. You've delivered me to King's Landing. Of course, in Jaime's style, he says all but a few fingers and a hand. but yeah, I think he's really concerned about her, and that plays out with how he's being very, very kind.
He is. And again, he's swallowing things he'd like to say to her. He's not saying some of the things that he wants to say. He is being kinder to her. So they keep going and they get to King's Landing, and you can tell it's just everything about King's Landing has changed. We get some totally nonsense information about some of the tax stuff has changed. They're riding through the streets and Jaime seeing a little bit of the fallout from the Battle of the Blackwater, and a little bit about Joffrey's death, although very little. He sees very little reaction to Joffrey's death, which surprises no one. And he finally gets to the Red Keep, and at the Red Keep is the first time anyone recognizes him. And it takes him talking to Meryn Trant to get Meryn Trant to recognize him. That's how different he looks than when he left King's Landing. I'm just continuing this whole theme of identity with Jaime.
I think it's interesting that we at this point see him actually criticize Cersei slightly in his head, like, how like Cersei to name me Lord Commander and then choose my colleagues without consulting me. I think, is that the first time we really see him criticizing Cersei internally?
It is. This is a new thing. And it's interesting, just as he reaches King's Landing, that he's having that sort of a thought, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's a continued theme from this point on, where you actually do see that shift in Jaime's perspective. And he does actually, I don't know whether or not he's beginning to realise things about Cersei now, or he's just giving them voice. But it's certainly something that is a continual theme throughout this chapter and also the next of Jaime's chapters.
Yeah, it's tough to know. Does it just matter now, or is he just noticing now? It is actually difficult to know. You feel like on some background, like, subconscious level, he was more aware of what Cersei was like, but it's definitely becoming more of an issue as they go forward. So he sees not only Meryn Trant, but two new members of the Kingsguard, and there's been a lot of churn in the Kingsguard since Jaime left King's Landing. And we see, I think it's Baelon Swan, and I know that we see Loras Tyrell. And we see Loras, and Loras sees Brienne.
Uh-oh.
And this is, of course, the first time that Loras has seen Brienne since they were at Bitter Bridge together, and Renly ended up dead. So, naturally, Loras confronts Brienne and basically says he'd like to kill her right then and there for killing Renly. Seems that he completely holds her responsible for that. And Brienne is, of course, trying in her own fumbling way to respond to this, but of course, you know, verbal response is never Brienne's best defensive mechanism.
No, it's not. So I think that's when Jaime needs to, he feels a need to step in. Things are getting a bit heated, and all Brienne can really do is kind of stand there and say, you know, I didn't kill him. That's pretty much it. So, the shadow did it.
Wizard did it.
Loras makes a grave error of questioning Brienne's honour, and then we see Jaime stepping in, you know, telling Loras, you know, she's honourable and whatnot. And then Loras gets a little bit arrogant, as he has a tendency to do, and tells Jaime to pretty much back off. Which then results in everyone drawing their swords, and then that results in a really great line from Jaime, which is basically, and I'll read it verbatim because I love it so, he tells him, "I am the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, you arrogant pup, your commander, so long as you wear that white cloak. Now sheathe your bloody sword or I'll take it from you and shove it up someplace even Renly never found." Which is so Jaime. Yes.
Chicky, I was wondering, maybe any of y'all that have read, maybe have read this book before the show, did you, whenever you read these books, could you tell that it was Renly lovers?
You know, that's an interesting question. I did, but you know, I didn't catch it until Storm of Swords. I know that very specifically. There's a line earlier in this book when Loras is talking to Tyrion that made it clear to me. I was like, oh, so that's what's going on there. I actually remember that really clearly. But so many people did not get the memo on this.
There's parts where he talks about him and Renly going to quote-unquote pray.
That's what the kids are calling it these days.
I don't know. Anyway, did anyone else read this before they saw it on the show, or no?
I didn't.
No. There was, it's interesting, there was a huge backlash in fandom when the show first came on, and I didn't learn about it until I finally watched the show, which was like maybe, I know it was after the second season. But I found out there was this huge backlash. People were like, why is the show making Renly and Loras gay? They're not gay in the books.
How can you read, "Now sheath your bloody sword or I'll take it from you and shove it up someplace Renly never found"?
It's pretty heavy subtext.
It's subtext? Pretty clear.
I feel like it's
Yes, it's probably even really subtext.
But people miss it. It's amazing how many people miss it. You know, I finally found, I don't know if you guys know what the So Spake Martins are, but there's something on Westeros.org where basically communications from George R.R. Martin, or even just things that he said verbally, people will send them in and they're kind of listed in a catalog, basically. And they're kind of an addendum to the text, kind of an add-on, you know, where you can go and check your facts. And it's a pretty good resource because George R.R. Martin actually asks them to remove things that aren't factual or that he didn't say or that he's worried are spoilers. So there is a So Spake Martin where Martin actually finally had to confirm at one point, yes, Renly and Loras are gay, for those of you who are missing it. So it's an important note that just because somebody says they don't see something in Martin's text doesn't mean it isn't there.
So. Well, are you suggesting that some people can't see what's happening in the text in relation
Would
to
I
certain
be?
Things?
Perhaps. So, the confrontation between Brienne and Loras ends when Jaime steps in, but the way that Jaime makes it end is that he has Brienne arrested. Loras says that he wants to charge her with murder, and Jamie's like, well, she didn't do it, but if you want me to lock her up, fine.
And she's so upset, isn't she? I think they describe it as her beautiful blue eyes. Well, they didn't say beautiful, but her beautiful blue eyes fill with hurt. Because, you know, this man, this amazingly complex man with whom she's bonded so intimately now. He saved her life more than once. He's now having her thrown in a jail cell. And, of course, then Jamie gets so upset because she's misunderstanding his actions. Because yes. Shouldn't she know him better by now? Aren't they in sync? Aren't they a team?
Exactly. You know, because so. Everybody loves to go to prison.
Well, exactly. It's more that, you know, Jamie's sick of being misunderstood, and he refers back to Eris again. And I think he is really more concerned that it's Brienne that's misunderstanding him, and she's not understanding that he's actually trying to step in and save her here.
Exactly.
And that he's got her back.
Yes. And, you know, on first read, I thought it was really crappy that Jamie did this to Brienne, because I was just like, why are you throwing her in prison? But, I mean, for him to do this, it's really for her own protection, you know. Loras, if she's walking around King's Landing, she's bound to get into a scuffle with Loras.
Absolutely.
Or, like, just talk to the wrong people, you know, and she's bound to wind up, you know, dead.
Well, so, you know what? I wouldn't be surprised, because she's not politically savvy. She tends to say whatever's on her mind. So I think that is a good point. He's actually doing her another favor by locking her up, although, you know.
And, you know, they probably put her in one of the higher levels of
she was put in a tower. Yeah, not a black.
So, I mean, it's the ones that are reserved for the highborn captives. Yeah. So
I just love
that.
The
you know. Sorry,
Brian. Go ahead, Rel.
Sorry, I just love the exact quote with, "You ought to be blowing me kisses, wench."
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, isn't that a fantastic quote? I imagine.
Oh,
midst of something that's really fraught, Jamie has to bring it back to something sexual. And I wonder, does Jamie feel like all the bros he saved in battle should be blowing him kisses? Or is this just specific to the bro TP that he has with Brienne?
Yes, because, you know, Sumner Crakehall should have blew him a kiss, you know, whenever
you
he
think so.
That's a danger all the time.
Exactly, and that's where he learned it, obviously.
You guys, Rose, was it you? Aaron, sorry. Did I send you
the drunken
ask?
Oh, God, probably.
My favorite quote is this quote, probably ever, of, "You ought to be blowing me kisses, wench, and one night, too much gin, I sent an ask," and I said, "You know, I just want to truncate this quote to, you ought to be blowing me."
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Isn't that kind of what he was thinking? Oh, just me.
No, he wasn't. He that would involve him being too honest with himself.
Yeah, I mean, subconsciously.
Like, I've got the book right in front of me. "You ought to be blowing me. If you just stop it there, you know, it's..."
Right?
I mean, it works.
Nothing wrong with that.
He's talking to Brienne.
That's a totally legitimate interpretation of that line.
Canon. Boom.
Canon, you guys.
Please, context.
Anyway, can we move along? Because I'm just a little bit excited to get to the step six.
Oh, God. What we're about to get to. Okay, so... Jamie goes... Actually, he thinks about going to his father first, but doesn't, because his father's in a meeting with both Mace Tyrell and Oberyn Martell. And he's like, nope.
What?
So he goes looking for Cersei and actually runs into Osmond Kettleblack, who is another new Kingsguard brother, and who doesn't recognize him. And actually, when Jaime says, "Let me into the Sept to see my sister," Osmond Kettleblack says, "You're her brother? Like, did you grow overnight or something?" He makes some joke about Tyrion being short. They don't get off to a good start, let's put it that way, Jamie and Osmond Kettleblack. So, finally, Jamie gets into the Sept, and he sees Cersei, and she's kneeling at the altar of the Mother. And I love this one little thought that he has. He sees all the candles, and I think there must be some sort of analogy to the Catholic Church and the lighting of candles for prayers for the departed. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, he says that the candles are prayers and that Joffs like to need every one of them.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too. And I think, as we were saying a little bit earlier when we were talking about Jamie and his grief or lack thereof for Joffrey, that he really did know that he was a monster. And because he didn't get the opportunity to bond with him at all, that's really all he sees him as.
Yeah, this is really the first time we get an inkling of his actual opinion of Joffrey's character. And it's not dissimilar to Tyrion's, you know, like both of these quote-unquote uncles. Obviously, Jaime's not actually their uncle, but know all three children fairly well. And it's pretty clear that... Yeah, father uncle. It's pretty clear...
Like brother
no
lover.
No one's a Joff fan.
Yeah. Sister, is anyone a Joff fan really other than Cersei?
Cersei's the sole Joff fan.
Although apparently in the show she wasn't a Joff fan. It's okay, let's not get into that.
No. There's plenty about the show to get into.
Yeah, there is.
So... Cersei sees Jaime and she's like, who is it? And Jaime, is it really you? And he has this thought before he even talks to her. As he's looking at her, she's still kneeling before the altar. Yeah. And he says, she has never come to me. She always waited, letting me come to her. She gives, but I must ask.
He's tired of being played. And I think, as Relly mentioned before, this is really... the beginning of the end for these guys. And we know that this scene is pretty much the beginning of the end. But, yeah, also in his internal monologue, we really see Jaime start to criticise Cersei, whereas we've never really seen that so much before.
Go ahead, Relly. Were you trying to break in?
Oh, no. I was now, but I wasn't before. I was just going to say, I think it's very interesting the bit where she refers to Joffrey as... my boy, and he thinks our boy.
Oh, yeah.
That does show how Cersei does tend to think of Jaime in terms of an extension to herself rather than his own individual person. It really wouldn't occur to her that to think about his feelings about Joffrey.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's just another indication of her narcissism. It's really all about her and her feelings. She doesn't really have the capacity to think outside of herself.
She really doesn't. And we see that here because she's looking at him and she's upset. She said, why didn't you come sooner? And he says, it's war out there. And she says, you look so thin and your
hair,
can
we just,
your golden hair.
You know, yeah? she talks about, why didn't you come sooner? And he says, I came as fast as I could, but did he? Or did he stop to save an ugly maiden from the bear?
And, you know, he really only misses the wedding by a day or two.
Right. So he really would have been there in time.
He actually probably would have been there.
I mean, it's not that he could have done anything to stop it. But I just thought that was worth pointing out.
It's interesting. It's interesting symbolism with him. It's his first choice of Brienne over Cersei, even if it's not a conscious choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it is. And we see him now seeing something he's been worried about since his first chapter, when he looked in at his own reflection in the water, which is, I don't look as much like Cersei, and she's not going to like that. And it is almost the first thing she comments on.
And isn't that interesting that is what she comments on? She doesn't immediately fly into a long-lost lover's arms. She doesn't ask him if he's okay. It's all, you look,
I think,
whatever.
They did hug first, but yeah, it
but
is
he, but
still the
she
first
didn't go
thing.
To him, as Jamie points out.
No, she didn't. Yeah, and he's known. We've known for 7 chapters that this was coming because he knew this was what she was going to say.
Yeah,
and he says to her, the hair will grow back, but he has to like hold up his stump because he knows he needs to show it to her. I think he knows on a subconscious level. And it's becoming conscious at this moment. He's like, she's got to see this because this is going to be an issue. And he's not wrong.
No, he's not.
So they talk through a little bit of what's gone on as far as his hand being cut off. And Cersei tells him that Tyrion killed Joffrey. And you see that Jaime, we saw on the road, Jaime rejected this idea. And Jaime listens to her. But he's not ready to believe it. Very clear. He's beginning to have a crisis of loyalty. He understands that Cersei is blaming Tyrion, but he's not ready to assume that Tyrion is guilty. Or even, it feels like, if Tyrion is guilty, to blame him.
I was just going to say, it was my impression upon reading that it's more... he doesn't want to, and yet you sort of get the impression that he can conceive of Tyrion's being capable of doing it.
Yeah. Well, I think one, he must know Joffrey and Tyrion's relationship.
Yeah.
And I think he knows Tyrion, and Tyrion certainly is capable of murder. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think a lot of it stems from his own guilt, because he feels, because of his lie to Tyrion. He knows that if
he does mention Tasha.
I think it's quite interesting that after the spit when we go on and Cersei says, you'll kill him for me, won't you? You'll avenge our son. It's suddenly their son. You know, it's no longer just someone when she wants Jaime to do something. Yeah. And I think there's a line either later or earlier where he talks about kinslayers being even more damned than kingslayers. So it's basically Cersei asking him to damn himself further, which is quite interesting, I think.
Well, isn't that kind of, I mean, this is really important to this chapter, and it's kind of the crux of their relationship, that it is a destructive relationship rather than constructive. Yes. And it's, I mean, you look at Martin and how he likes to deconstruct tropes, and here he's very much playing with the one true love trope, but presenting it in a way that rather than it being, you know, a true love, a love that is I guess, a love that saves all. It's more a love that is very, very destructive for both parties, and not just the lovers, but pretty much everyone around them.
Yeah, yeah, all of Westeros.
And then, you know, we...
You go ahead. I was just going to say that it's definitely not a healthy relationship. Martin has said that before he walks into the Sept, Cersei thinks that he's possibly dead. She hasn't heard from him. They think he might have been dead. And whenever she turns around and sees him, her reactions, I mean, her first reaction, she, you know, he has to come to her. It looks like she's repulsed by his stump.
Right. And really, do you,
I mean... And then she begins to manipulate him. No.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It kind of culminates with this amazingly twisted sex scene, which really is... not tender, it's not loving. Jaime's acting on animal instinct. Cersei is using it as a manipulative tool, and it really is an amazing metaphor for their actual relationship.
It is interesting. I think Cersei might actually be into it.
I think she's into it, but it would be very difficult for me to believe that there's not some manipulation at play, particularly as she's just had this conversation with Jaime about,
you'll
kill Tyrion for me, won't you?
Yeah, right. He's questioning her about Tyrion's guilt.
Yeah.
And the next thing we know, Joffrey is our son, not just her son.
But
and
she is completely into it. with that.
I think she is. So we jump into the good stuff here. And I mean, it is good, bad
Jaime
stuff.
Jaime jumped right in, so why should I
wait? Jaime really does. I'm ready. Let's go.
I'm so ready, you guys. My body is ready.
Take it away. I mean, you guys feel like... I feel like you can do this on your own. Go.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't know. There's not really much more to say than that for me to say, I guess. It's just a really gloriously fucked up scene here.
Oh, I love it. I love it so much.
It's amazing. And you know what? We actually mentioned this before. I think Chicky was saying how many Jaime and Brienne shippers don't like this scene, or they can't stand it because they tend to see it as... as interfering with the Jaime Brienne relationship. But to me, it's really the complete opposite. What you have here is the beginning of the end of Jaime and Cersei. And I did mention this briefly. It's not a romantic scene. They go out of their way, or George goes out of his way to say there's no tenderness in it. It's taking place in this place of worship next to Joffrey's decaying body, the product of their incest, just right there. And, you know, looking at the motivations behind why this is happening, okay, yes, I agree. I'm sure there's been some longing and both parties are into it, that's true, but I think it's very much an animal act on Jaime's part and a manipulative one on Cersei's part. So when you take the motivation behind the sex along with the venue, it makes it this entirely twisted thing, which is much like the relationship between Jaime and Cersei.
And as if that wasn't enough, she's also on her period. Thank you, George R. Martin. I love you.
And you know, so I know some people believe that that was George's way of indicating that, you know, any further children Cersei might have aren't Jaime's, although it is very possible to get pregnant on your period. But I have seen that explored. Chicky, have you got any opinions on that?
I definitely think that may be why he did it.
Yeah.
He wanted to make sure there was no question in that vein.
You know, it baffles me.
I was just going to say, I think it's very interesting that he chose for Cersei to be on her period during this sex scene, especially when you consider the massive cultural taboo that the medieval church had against sex during a woman's period. Because, of course, for this podcast, I went away and did some rather disturbing research.
Yeah, oh, God, I hope you did.
Medieval attitudes to period sex. And it was thought that if a couple had sex during a woman's period and the woman got pregnant, that the child would be hideously deformed and leprous.
Well, that explains Joffrey.
Yeah, maybe they did it that time.
Deformed on the inside.
And that also, while they're having sex, the man's penis would get infected with the woman's venom.
That is
period. Blood was supposed to be venomous.
Guys, that is so smart. I mean, think about it. Jamie's now been away from her for so long, he's starting to see the light.
This explains so much.
Yes. But you know, it's interesting you mention it was taboo, because isn't that kind of what Jaime and Cersei are all about? You know, engaging in these taboo acts without sort of any fear of reprisal.
And you know that right there? It seems like everybody is more bothered about her being on her period than the actual incest going on. Everybody in Hartley seems
more used to that by now, though.
Eked out about the period blood.
Yeah. I would like to talk a little bit about how the book treated this scene as opposed to the show, if everyone's okay with that.
I'm fine with it. I trigger warned for it, so go for it.
Because in this scene, in the book scene, Cersei does protest weakly about what's happening. It's more about her thoughts about where they're actually having the sex. She's saying, not here. Jaime responds by essentially saying he doesn't care, they've played this game before. Then Cersei clearly consents. She clearly consents to this sex that's happening. And I'm going to do a slight dramatic reading. I wasn't going to.
But oh, my God, do it. Do it.
I feel like it's necessary. She says,
it is.
She says, okay, hurry. She was whispering now. Quickly, quickly, now. Do it now. Do me now. Jamie. Her hands helped guide him. Yes, Cersei said as he thrust. My brother, sweet brother, yes, like that. Yes, I have you. You're home now, you're home now, you're home. She kissed his ear and stroked his short, bristly hair. Now, that is a paragraph of consent. That is clear consent to me. She is saying, do me now, Jamie. Her hands help guide him inside her. She says yes multiple times. She's kissing his ear. She's stroking his hair. So to me, and I assume to you guys, that clearly reads as a consensual act of sex, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay?
No question. And if there was any question, George R.R. Martin has actually explicitly said that Cersei was anxious and eager for the sex. He actually has, in a rare move for him, come out and clarified a scene in his books. Because so people... After the show scene aired, we had people saying that this book scene was not consensual, and we actually had the author come out and say that it was.
People actually did come out and say, okay, it doesn't matter that the show scene was rape because it was rape in the books. And I'm like, what are you reading?
I think they stopped reading after a certain point. Yeah.
They stopped reading after he protested.
Completely out of context.
Yeah. So, I mean, compare this now to the show scene. And I don't really want to soapbox it. I just want to state the facts as best I can. So this is season 4, episode 3. I think it's Breaker of Chains. Anyway, what happens is, yay, Jamie embraces Cersei. They begin to kiss. It's all very consensual to me at this stage. Both parties are clearly into it. Then what happens is Cersei sees Jaime's stump and she recoils. Jaime responds by calling her a hateful woman with quite a venomous tone. And then he violently grabs her head and kisses her. She begins to struggle, but she also seems to still be responding a little bit. Then it gets a little bit murky. Right. Jaime pulls her to the ground and Cersei is saying repeatedly, Jaime, please, please, stop it, stop it. He is tearing away her small clothes at this stage. Jaime then replies, no. Then there is more of Cersei telling him to stop it while banging against his chest with her fists. She does at one stage seem to kiss him back and grasp his face a little bit, so you can still see the push-pull happening. But then Jamie pushes her to the floor. He climbs on top of her, which is pinning her in place because, you know, he's a guy. He's a big guy. He's a heavy guy. And then Cersei resumes banging her fists against his chest and saying, stop it, stop it. It's not right. It's not right. And at this point, it really sounds like she's crying. And this is where, to me, it is blatantly clear she is not consenting. If she ever had consented, she has withdrawn that consent.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is a thing, okay? That is a thing. Even if you consent to sex, you can always revoke that consent at any time.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if he thought she had consented before by kissing him back and grabbing his face. Here, she's clearly telling him, no, not here, stop. She's crying. She's banging her fists against him. So, you know, we've got Jamie thrusting away inside her while saying, I don't care, I don't care. And then we see this horrifying image of Cersei grabbing onto Joffrey's shroud, I think it is. And then we get a fade to black. So yeah. In my mind, those two scenes are completely worlds apart. The only similarities that they have are that there was a little bit of push-pull to start with. But the way that that scene ended, and they could have ended it maybe, what, 30 seconds beforehand, a minute beforehand, and it might have remained ambiguous to me. I mean, I would have preferred more of an overt consent. But anyway, I think we all agree.
It was rape on the show. Yeah. What they portrayed was rape. Whatever they intended, what they showed was rape. There was no final consent there, and it was horrific to watch.
Were you gonna
especially for those of us who are fans of the books and Jamie.
I think it's just an offshoot of the show downplaying Cersei's manipulative side. I think they were trying to play up her vulnerability in the scene and just completely misjudged it, and it comes off horribly. But I don't really understand their need to play up Cersei's vulnerability, actually, because
they've really done not a great job with Cersei's characterization in the show. It is quite different to the way she's portrayed in the books, in my opinion.
It is.
Okay, guys, I gotta do it.
Are you gonna talk about how he cleaned up her period blood from the floor?
Oh, such a gentleman. No. I had been joking. I had been looking forward to this scene in the show forever. You guys know this, and I'd been joking for the longest time.
We were into it.
Yeah, we all were.
You know we were into it.
We had that tiny chat that you posted to Tumblr.
It was going to be great, you guys. It was going to be great. We could have had it all. See how they could possibly mess it up. We could have had it all, but you know, I used to joke that, like, if I were the director of the Sept scene, how I would film it. Yes, consensual, obviously. I would follow the book, but I would also follow it like an action film. And I always made the joke of, like, I really want to play up the fact that she's on her period. I want it to just be like, you know, Jamie thrusts and there's like blood shooting out towards the camera. And I just, you know, that was a joke. And the sad thing is that my joking vision of the scene is actually better than what we ended up with.
It would have been about 100 times better, okay?
It would have been amazing. I was actually going to take the scene in the show and, like, add the blood squirts, but, you know, because we've got the rape scene instead, I had to just stop watching.
I'm super pissed they ruined this for us, you guys.
I know. My opportunity. My golden opportunity. It's gone.
Oh, God. It would have made
They could have added some lightsabers as well, like I usually do.
Some sparkles.
Still waste. Sparkles, yes, sparkles, blood, lightsabers. It was gonna be, you know, Oscar worthy editing skills going on.
They would have asked you to actually come in and direct, but alas.
They would have. Oh, 100%. No doubt.
Damn it. Oh.
Such a waste.
Damn it. If only you'd done it.
I know.
I should have pitched that scene to HBO and they'd be like, this is brilliant. You are the genius we need.
You actually were the genius they needed. God, if only they knew.
I'm pretty sure anyone could have directed that scene better.
Yeah, I feel like that may be true.
Probably would have, yeah.
Probably a 7-year-old off the street could have showed better consent. God, I hope they never do that.
So anyway, Jamie reluctantly rolls away and helps her off the altar.
He does, and he has a really great line in the books.
About Sept catching fire.
Yeah, he realized he's knocked all the candles over, and he says, if the Sept had caught fire, I might never have noticed. And this is just such a great analogy for their relationship, which is just, it's so obsessive and all-consuming for him that he just doesn't notice what the collateral damage is of it.
Yeah, they're like burning the world down around them and they don't even know.
Yeah.
Couldn't the candles also be, candles going out, be something from his dream? The lights going down?
Could be, but it
damn it, Eon. Maybe I've never heard that.
Maybe even indicate the death of the relationship.
Well, then, I mean, you have, like, that line, and I love this line. He says, I crossed 1,000 leagues to come to you and lost the best part along the way. Don't tell me to leave. And she tells him to leave me, and she turns away.
Yeah, basically, after they've done the deed, you know, she recoils from his stump, unlike in the show. And Jamie...
And actually, he proposes.
He does. I was going to say, Jamie talks to her a little bit about, you know what, I'm tired of being careful. Let's just bring this all out in the open. Let's get married. And Cersei freaks out. And then she mentions about how he's changed. She's noticed that he's changed. And then she gets really, I guess, upset or angry with it and tells him to leave her. She doesn't want to deal with it anymore, despite the fact that he, as Ian was just saying, pleads for her to say, you know, don't send me away. She's very cold and just says, leaves me and turns from him.
Yeah, and you're right. It's such a great line, Eon. Oh, God, I love that line.
Mm.
So she basically sends him away and he leaves. And this is, again, if you take that sept sex scene out of context, like the context wherein she's the queen regent and he's just the lord commander of the Kingsguard and she can order him to do whatever she wants and does right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty clear who holds the power in this relationship, both, you know, I mean, overtly and kind of covertly, both directions, Cersei has it. Anyway, Jaime leaves her and goes to Tywin, and he's in a mood, you can tell, between what happened with Loras and Brienne in the yard, and then this big fight, and it was a fight that he just had with Cersei over him proposing to her and her completely roundly rejecting the idea. He goes to see Tywin, and Tywin... It's interesting how Jamie describes this. He walks in the room and Tywin's alone and Tywin goes, Jamie. And he says, Lord Tywin said, as if they'd last seen each other at breakfast.
Yeah.
Like, Tywin is going to give him no acknowledgement of his ordeal whatsoever.
It's
like no one's actually, you know, running into his arms, pleased to see
poor
him.
Jamie.
Everyone's just like, no. Oh, back.
You know what, you guys? Brienne would have run into his arms if they'd been separated. Do you think that's...
Oh, I think she would have wanted to, but she'd be too shy, so she'd just want to, like, wave at him, but look at him
she'd
longingly.
Blush.
Like,
well, we did see the
if you compare this to the motion even in their reunion scene later on, you
even
know.
That's more caring what happened between Jaime and Cersei.
It is.
And Jaime and his own father.
Yeah. Tom is just kind of like, oh, hey, so, like,
did you get me a souvenir or something while you were gone?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm always distracted in this scene because we've gone straight from the sept scene to, you know, to going with the meeting with Tywin. And I don't, like, it's just me, I know. But Jamie really should have, after the sept scene, gone and had a bath and, you know, washed his junk because, like,
it would have been nice.
Hang on, didn't Brienne already wash his junk? Oh, sorry, you mean
that. Oh, that was earlier.
My, oh my.
Yeah, just go back to Brienne. Oh, hey, while you're at it. Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
But he does finally get a reaction out of Tywin. He does get a reaction out of Tywin when he shows Tywin his stump. That kind of gets Tywin going a little bit. And we learn that Tywin knew that Jaime was on the loose, had been released from River Run. And we hear it's very clear that Tywin had been talking to Roose. So Tywin drops an interesting bit of information in Jamie's lap and says that Gregor Clegane has recaptured Harrenhal and he's taken the goat prisoner, Vargo Hoat.
Well, he's also taken the hoat.
I like it, the hoat.
Taking the hoat and the goat and the boat. Sailing down
and
the
that he was able to capture Harrenhal easily because Vargo's men, most of them deserted him because he had been fevered from a wound that
he's
festered.
Gone crazy.
We hear that it was a wound in his ear. So basically, Brienne took Vargo Hoat down. She didn't realize it, but by biting
and
his ear.
And how much
off.
Do you love it's... Jamie's immediate thought is to share this awesome news with Brienne, his new BFF?
He thinks it's hilarious.
He loves it.
I just love the poetic justice of Vargo Hoat being taken down by what is basically an amputation, but
right.
Yes. With teeth.
I love it. And yeah, Jamie wants to tell Brienne. He knows she's not going to think it's as funny as he does, but he can't wait to tell her.
Right?
And I feel like that's a really good indication of the relationship that they have now. I think people don't realize just how much time they've spent with one another. Sure, you've seen what you've seen in their chapters, but the amount of time that they've spent with
it's not just the time, it's the quality of the time as well.
Also the fact that
they've endured so much together, and people bond through trauma.
For months they've been together, and they have come to know one another very well.
So
Tywin basically asks him, if he can function without his hand, and he's like, can you use a sword with your left hand? And Jamie has this interesting response of, I can hardly dress myself in the morning, but he's got a lot of bravado with his father. He doesn't want to reveal his weaknesses to his father. He's like, oh yeah, it's the same as the other hand. I can use it. It'll work just as well.
It's not just his dad too. It's really with everyone comes across, I guess, other than Cersei.
Now that he's back in King's Landing,
he's gonna have to keep doing this.
So Jaime basically asks his dad a little bit about what happened with Tyrion. Did Tyrion actually kill Joffrey? And we get a little bit more information on that, and then the conversation works its way around to Renly. They're talking about Tyrion's trial, and Jaime's kind of scoffing at the idea that Tyrion might have justice. And Jamie says, Renly died strangely as well when Stannis needed him to, implying that maybe Joffrey had been killed by someone else, maybe Stannis. And Tywin says what we've been hearing rumors about, which is that, Renly was murdered by Brienne. It's pretty clear here, he calls her the woman from Tarth, but it's pretty clear how widely this legend has spread about Brienne. Not only had Jaime and Kleos heard about it in the Riverrun dungeons, but Tywin Lannister has even heard this rumor.
And he makes a grievous error of insulting Brienne's honor in front of Jaime, because Jaime immediately replies, that woman from Tarth is the reason I'm here.
Yeah. He does.
It's an interesting contrast between how fervently he defends her here to with Loras, where he was like,
I think he knew he had to calm Loras down as well, because Loras was really agitated and there were swords all around him.
It's another one of those moments as well where what Jamie thinks and what he says are two completely different things in regards to Brienne.
Yeah. Oh, Jamie. Oh, he's so complex, you guys.
He certainly is
going to stand up for Brienne at every opportunity.
Yeah, he is. Only I may call her wench.
Yeah. So then we get to Tywin having the great bright idea that Jaime having his hand cut off is a good reason to get him out of the Kingsguard. And you kind of have to assume one of two things. Either Tywin was already planning to come up with an excuse to get him out of the Kingsguard, or Tywin is just, working on the fly. He sees that this amputation and he's like, aha, finally I can get him out of this Kingsguard and make him
my heir
again.
I should have thought of doing that myself.
Yeah, exactly. Why didn't I cut his hand off?
I was wondering if Tywin already knew about Jaime's hand being cut off before Jaime even got there. Because whenever he comes up there, Tywin's about to give him a gift, which I think is most likely Oathkeeper.
I'm pretty sure he mentions he doesn't know.
Yeah, he says he doesn't know. He seems really surprised, Tywin does, at the loss of the hand.
Yeah, he gets very, very agitated about it, actually.
But it's interesting, Jaime is insisting he will stay in the Kingsguard. He is having none of this idea of the stump being enough to get him out of the Kingsguard. And he pretty roundly rejects the idea of
stepping out. He says no, like, six times in a row.
Yeah.
He does. Not only to that, Tywin saying, I'll send you back to the Rock, I'll send Tommen with you, we need to get her away from Cersei, and then he's like, oh, I'm gonna marry Cersei off to Oberyn Martell. And Jaime is like, no.
He's had enough. He doesn't want Cersei away, he's tired of his family, he's tired of being used as a pawn, so he's just had enough.
And he's doing what actually none of Tywin's kids have done up to this point, which is just completely refuse what his father wants him to do. Wants to marry Cersei to Oberyn. He actually wants to marry Jaime to Margaery, of all the crazy shit.
I don't know, is it any crazier than her marrying Tommen?
Oh, God. That's crazy. They do want to marry her to Tommen. So anyway, this is another fight that Jaime has, and it ends in Tywin telling him, "You are not my son. If you're going to be Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, good luck with that. Go ahead."
We have some nice mirroring here, where both Tywin and Cersei have essentially ended their conversations with Jaime by telling him to get the fuck out.
Welcome home, Jaime.
Welcome home, you handless bastard.
I can't imagine having a father like Tywin, because there's this line at the end where it says, "Firelight gleamed golden in the stiff whiskers that framed Lord Tywin's face, a vein pulsed in his neck, but he did not speak, and he did not speak, and did not speak." And I'm just like, reading that, I'm just like, can you imagine Tywin looking at you, and it's just this stare that you just want to climb underneath a rock Absolutely. Just to get away from.
Absolutely. Yeah. Underneath a Casterly rock?
Yes.
I think it's interesting that both Tywin and Cersei do really just see Jaime as extensions of themselves. He's very much, when he's not of use to them, is when they dismiss him. Poor Jaime.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, now he's put his best friend in jail as well for our own protection. So he's just sort of like, oh, shit, my bro's in jail as well.
It was going to go hang out with a rough 24 hours for Jaime. He pretty much had trouble with all the people he's close to. Tyrion may have betrayed him. Brienne is convinced that he betrayed her. He and Cersei had a huge fight, and his father disowned him. It was a really rough chapter for Jaime. So we move from that chapter into Jaime 8. And if Jaime 7 was about Jaime dealing with his personal life, Jaime 8 is about Jaime trying to deal with his professional life. Maybe like many of us who are like, well, this part of my life is a big fail right now, so I'm going to go try to clean up this area instead.
Yeah. I'd just like to really take this chapter apart and do a word count of how many times the word white appears. Because on the first page, it appears to be there about 12 times.
I love the first line. A white book sat on a white table in a white room. I just love it.
Jaime looks out with the whites of his eyes and he's
white. I like the imagery. I like the imagery. But yeah, Jamie's there and everything's white. Everything's pure, but not.
Definitely not. No. So he's in White Sword Tower, which are kind of like
a minute,
the barracks.
Wait a minute, is it
white? Kind of like the barracks of the Kingsguard. And he's in the main room, and he is preparing, we will find, for a meeting with the Brothers of the Kingsguard. And this is the first one that's been called since he's been made Lord Commander. I don't know what the timeline is on this. I think at least like a fortnight or so has passed. I know Brienne is in those cells, according to most timelines, for about a month at least, maybe 6 weeks. It's a long time.
Baby.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that long. Aww.
I love how much research I actually do before I just hop into podcast and wing it from my memory, which is notoriously terrible. But so Jamie's wearing a sword again, but he's like, oh, it's on the wrong hip because he's had to switch because he switched sword hands since he lost the other one. He's back in the winter clothing of the Kingsguard, but he's like, oh, it's too big. It's loose on him. He's
everything
lost so much weight.
Everything's feeling wrong to
Everything Jackie. Feels wrong. Yeah, they've moved him into the quarters of the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. And he's like, you know, I'll like this. You know, it's going to work.
Like he's trying to convince himself.
It is.
Cool. It's going to be good.
It has a nice view.
I like my spacious new rooms. It's got to be
We learn that Tywin has definitely still disowned him. They're still not talking, really. We learn that Cersei hasn't seen him alone since their fight in the Sept, and that Jaime's spending his days at Tyrion's trial, where not only does Tyrion not recognize him, but he says most of the court doesn't even know who he is. He's so changed in appearance.
Yeah, and they make a point of mentioning that he spends his days at the trial standing to the back of the hall. Now, Whether that's because Jaime's purposely trying to avoid being seen supporting Tyrion because of what comes next, or whether it's just because Jaime is conflicted about his loyalty and he's not sure what to believe, so he's keeping his distance, or maybe it's both. But I find it interesting that George sort of specifies that that's what's happening.
He does, and I feel like we actually get some hints in this chapter about what Jaime's intentions may be.
Yeah.
So Jaime is the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, and he's sitting in the chair of the Lord Commander, and he's thinking about the men who've come before him and how worthy they were of the chair, and he thinks, how does the Kingslayer belong in such exalted company? You get this vague underlying almost self-loathing from him as far as his worthiness to be Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. He's like, I killed my king, basically. Do I deserve this? And what's interesting is, given what's left of the Kingsguard, it almost feels like he still is absolutely the best choice.
Right? Yeah. Although I do like Balon Swan. He's cool with me.
Yeah, so far.
So far.
Give him a chance.
I don't think he's... Yeah.
So it's
Loras
interesting. Jaime's
to step up.
Yeah. Jaime's looking through the White Book, the Book of Brothers, which is pretty much the history of the Kingsguard that has a page for every brother who's ever served, and it has kind of their history, their complete history, not just within the Kingsguard, on each page, and he's reading Barristan's page, and I love this about Barristan. Barristan Selmy was dismissed by Joffrey and Cersei for being too old to be in the Kingsguard at all, even let alone Lord Commander, and Barristan went and sat in White Sword Tower and finished his entry before he left.
This is so hilarious to me.
I might be
they were going to arrest him, and now imagine Barristan racing up to the White Sword Tower to update his profile before absconding from the castle.
He didn't care.
It's funny because they sent them after him really straight away, didn't they? And
they did. Yeah, they tried to kill him as he was leaving the city.
Anyone else got this Monty Python thing happening where he's being chased through the castle and locks himself into the tower so he can update? Oh, God.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Did no one think to look for him in the White Tower?
Apparently not.
Just here updating my profile page.
So Jaime reads Barristan's entire page. We get a lot of exposition in this chapter about a lot of people, and most of them Kingsguard. And then Jaime looks at his own page, and Barristan has just this page and a half full of deeds, and Jaime's amounts to a paragraph.
He did some stuff. Yeah, whatever.
He did a little something once.
He did something once.
And he's clearly bothered by it. He kind of is annoyed Gerald Hightower started the paragraph, and then Barristan Selmy finished the second half of it, but clearly Barristan quit adding anything pretty much almost immediately after Robert's Rebellion. He just didn't want to list anything Jaime had done. We know Jaime was, you know, he won some tournaments, and we know that he was probably involved in the Ironborn Rebellion. Nothing about any of that. So Jaime's like rolling back through his life and everything that Barristan should have included, and he thinks about what we see him revisit many times is probably one of his finer moments, fighting with Arthur Dayne against the Kingswood Brotherhood. And he has one of his more poignant lines in response to that when he's thinking about how he first fought the Smiling Knight, who was this terrible outlaw, and how Arthur Dayne had to finish the guy off. And Jaime just thinks about, you know, everyone who was there to witness that and how they're all dead. And he's like, When did the boy I was die as well? Was it when I took the white cloak? When I opened Aerys' throat? And he says the boy had wanted to be Sir Arthur Dayne, who was his hero. He says, but someplace along the way, he had become the Smiling Knight instead. So he's acknowledging that he has become essentially the villain of the story.
It's such a poignant line, and it's one of my favorites from Jaime as well. And it's really telling of Jaime's mindset here, I think, as well. I guess Jaime, we all know that he was very young when he joined the Kingsguard, and it was really under false pretenses because he thought it was because he was amazing with a sword. And then he very quickly, on the same day that he was actually appointed, finds out that it was more that Aerys wanted to spite Tywin and take his heir from him. And Jaime, at that point, or before, just before that, he really wanted to be, I guess, what you would view as the archetypal knight. It's this idealistic view of a knight that a 15-year-old Jaime believed in, that would be honourable and just and kind of blindly loyal. I don't know. That I really adore that quote. Actually, it makes me quite emotional when I read it, because I don't know how anyone can read Jaime's story and hear his thoughts and not feel a huge amount of empathy for him.
I think we all agree.
Yeah. But, you know, there are people that disagree, right? There are people who still see Jaime as a complete villain. And, you know, shades of grey. I'm not saying that Jaime hasn't done some horrendous things. But, oh, God, you really need to take it in the context of Jaime's entire story. And it is really a sad story.
And he's fairly self-aware.
He is self-aware.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, he does have a lot of guilt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really does. And it's funny that he talks a little bit earlier about those great men that went before him. And I think he talks to himself and says, they were made of finer steel back then, both the men and the swords. And then he thinks to himself, or was it just because I was 15 at the time? Or, you know, was the world simpler back then?
So typically Jaime. He's such a romantic on one hand and then a cynic on the other.
I love it. And it's, you know, as we know, it's very unlikely the world was simpler back then. And those men to whom Jaime refers, the ones that were made of finer steel, we're talking about the same men who stood by and watched while Aerys raped his wife and burnt people alive. So it's really, truly reflective of how Jaime was very, very young, probably wearing rose-tinted glasses. And I guess that's true of human nature, really. You do look back to when you were younger and think it was a simpler time because you weren't yet old enough to grasp the shades of grey, I guess, in life.
You know, it does make me wonder that if Jaime had the opportunity to enter the Kingsguard at a later age, like maybe around the same age as Loras, 17, 18 maybe, if he would have joined the Kingsguard.
Yeah.
That actually is a good question.
It's interesting.
Well, he probably would have been married by then.
Right.
Probably. Yeah. To Lysa.
Oh, man.
Good times. That's
so close. Jaime and Lysa.
That's Aaron's second.
Match made in hell.
Oh, totally.
So the brothers arrive, and there are only five of them there besides Jaime, six total. Aerys, Okkartz, and Dorne. And Jaime looks around at the group. It's Boris Blunt, Meryn Trant, Osmond Kettleblack, Baelin Swan, and Loras Tyrell. And Jaime looks at them and he's like, what would Arthur Dayne have said about these guys?
What would Arthur Dayne do?
In case anyone has missed
it. Blow them all kisses. That's what he would do.
Bro kisses.
Jaime fanboys Arthur Dayne pretty hard, in case anyone missed it. He's clearly his ultimate ideal of a hero.
He was made of fine steel.
He was. And Jaime knew him fairly well, and still Jaime respected him this much. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, he thinks of Arthur Dayne asking, you know, how has the Kingsguard fallen so low? And Jaime thinks to himself that he would have to say, it was my doing. I would have to answer. I opened the door and did nothing when the vermin began to crawl inside. And it's like he understands that him killing Aerys was the beginning of the end for the Kingsguard.
Yeah,
and it's interesting how he has to deal with that. And he's like, but we still exist. I still have to try to make the best of this.
And that is essentially what he's doing now in this chapter, isn't it? He really sort of steps into the Lord Commander role, and he's, I guess, trying to sort shit out.
He's really trying. So he starts taking them all to task for Joffrey having died on their watch, and very cleverly manages to kind of segue that into questioning them about Tyrion's guilt, something you can see he is very interested in. He wants to know what the real story is. He's heard the rhetoric. He's heard his father's story and Cersei's story. He's been at the trial. He wants to know, you know, what they have to say. He knows all five of these guys were really close to the action. And he gets, you know, Baelon Swan to admit there were a lot of people who had access to Joffrey's cup. And then he gets Loras Tyrell to say that he believes that Sansa did it.
Yeah. And Jaime does like this. He likes this line of thinking because, you know,
he does.
Would exonerate Tyrion, obviously.
It would exonerate Tyrion, exactly. And it's clearly what he was looking for. It was clearly what he wanted to hear. And we actually get him making a reference to Varys in his thoughts, too, about Varys possibly helping Sansa escape or something to the effect that Varys knows a lot about the Red Keep, which probably will come into play later. So from there, Jaime goes through the Kingsguard one by one and deals with them is the best way to put it. He starts with Boris Blunt and makes Boris Blunt Tommen's food taster, which
I love it.
Oh, it feels so good. If you've been reading like the series, Chicky. It does feel like justice because you've seen what Boris Blunt has been, and he's
the way he dealt with Sansa for a start.
Yes,
yeah, you're happy to see him get his comeuppance. And I love how he just, it's funny.
Can I read the quote? Because I love it. Okay. He says to Boris, "My sister has told me how readily you yielded my nephew to Tyrion sellswords. You will find carrots and peas less threatening, I hope. When your sworn brothers are training in the yard with sword and shield, you may train with spoon and trencher. Tommen loves apple cakes. Try not to let any sellswords make off with them." I'm just like,
I love how Boris Blunt calls Jaime a cripple, too.
Yeah.
So that's Boris Blunt pretty well dealt with. I mean, Jaime tells him, you know, if you want to fight me over this, go ahead. And Boris Blunt backs down.
Yeah.
And it's funny. We see Jaime just kind of bluffing his way through all of these situations because he knows.
You know what else? The impression I got as I was reading through this is, because you see Jaime deal with Boris and then he deals with Osmond Kettleblack and then Meryn Trant and then basically he deals with each of his brothers in turn and you see how he adjusts his way of dealing with them depending on who he's talking to. And it really is indicative to me of how Jaime is actually really excellent at reading people, even though he doesn't always put that into practice.
I don't know, it
was something that struck me because he did really change his approach in how he was dealing with each of them depending on what he thought was necessary.
Yes, and it's interesting, you see this in all three of Tywin's children in their POVs that they're reading people.
Yeah.
What's fascinating is that Tyrion and Jaime are pretty good at it and Cersei's really rotten at it.
She thinks she's
great.
Yeah. So.
And she gets worse as the books go on.
She does, yeah.
I was going to say, much like with everything else, she thinks she's good at it when she's not.
Yeah.
Oh, so.
But when he's dealing with Boris, Jaime has this line that he thinks to himself, which is that they feared the man I was, the man I am they pity, and he's just bluffing his way through.
Yeah.
So he deals with Osmond and basically calls Osmond Kettleblack as a fraud, as a fraud. He's like, who knighted you? Yeah. Who? And he's like, where are you from? And of course, you know, Osmond has no real answers. And Jaime's like, well,
he was knighted by Robert Stone. You know,
Robert. I'm surprised he didn't say Robert White or just right. I was knighted by White.
He's looking
at the
walls.
Yeah,
Robert Table.
He's dead now, you guys. But it don't happen.
But Jaime can't do anything about it. This guy's a member of the Kingsguard. He can't get rid of him. So he's just like, "All right, you're dismissed." So he's dismissed Blunt. He's dismissed Kettleblack. Moves on to Meryn Trant, who he absolutely calls out for beating Sansa Stark, which to me is one of the more clear indicators that, you know, Jaime is not of the caliber of these other guys.
Yeah. Well, we already know that he abhors violence towards women. And I think he must find Sansa's treatment especially heinous because she was, you know, she's just a kid.
Yeah. And so helpless.
But what's also interesting about Jaime's interaction with Meryn Trant is when he discusses Tommen with him. Because when Jaime gets on to Meryn about chastising, as he puts it, Sansa, Meryn essentially says to him, you know, it's our duty to obey the king. I was just acting under the king's orders. And then Jaime says, well, you know what? This king is 8. So if he does make any demands that you find unsavory, and we know that Meryn probably didn't even find the thing about Sansa unsavory, but Jaime's basically saying, come to me. We're not just going to blindly follow this king. Is he trying to change up the Kingsguard a little bit by saying we need to use our our logic when we're dealing with the king's demands now.
He's trying to...
He really is.
And I think he is essentially trying to avoid another Joffrey situation. I wonder if he worries that Tommen may inherit some of Joffrey's sociopathy. I don't know. It doesn't seem evident at this point. But anyway, I'm diverging. Anyway, carry on.
Erin, did you have something to say?
No, I was just laughing. Okay. Although, I do. I just want to take it back to Kettle Black for a moment because I love how fake Kettle Black is. And he's just like trying to be Jamie's best buddy. Like, hey, bro, how you doing? Remember Robert Stone?
He wants to be the new Brienne to Jamie.
He really does. And Jamie's just like, what you guys
position
doing?
Taken. Position filled.
Get out.
I'm not going to blow you any kisses. That's for damn sure.
I'm not going to blow anything. Okay, carry on.
Ew. So from Meryn, we move on to Baelon Swan, and you can see that Jamie has less of a problem.
You guys, he is totes into Baelon Swan, and I think I am too.
But I wouldn't say he has no problem with Baelon Swan, because the problem with Baelon Swan is his family, in that Baelon's father is a little bit like Tywin was during Robert's Rebellion. He just didn't declare for a side during the War of the Five Kings.
Yeah. And I think they talk about Baelon's brother declaring for everyone.
Yes, and Baelon's brother.
It's like Renly then Stannis.
Who was Renly then Stannis, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Jamie being very snarky there, saying he might have been the first knight in the realm to swear fealty to all six kings.
Yeah, that's a good line.
Brienne is a close second.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting that in the show then Cersei calls out Brienne for the same thing.
Yeah.
Damn it, Cersei. Anyway.
So Jamie basically says, you know, what happens to you when your brother comes storming the throne room, and who do you choose, Tommen or your brother? And you know, you see Baelon Swan kind of trying to dodge the question, and he's like, well, that'll never happen. And Jamie's like, it happened to me.
Yeah. Like,
of course it can happen. And Baelon Swan goes, I'll never do what you did, I swear.
Yeah, which is, you know, Jamie laughs at it because what else can he do? I mean, he can't deny it. He's not a hypocrite.
No, he's not.
and yet, oh, God, I love the complexity of Jamie's story much.
Well, there was, as far as Baelon Swan in a Game of Thrones, Littlefinger actually brought up Baelon Swan as a possible ally for Ned in like the power struggle against Cersei, but Ned actually chose to recruit the Gold Cloak.
Damn it, Ned!
Instead, yeah. So I mean, Baelon Swan could be, you know, have the same traits as like his dad and his brother. Also,
You never know.
He could.
Could it be a full
You know
shot?
What's interesting about this whole scene is that Aerys Elkhart isn't there. Aerys or Aerys, I have no idea how they're going to pronounce it. Oh, he's not going to make the show. Why am I even
guessing? He's not. You're not going to need to worry about that.
No worries. Sir not appearing in this film.
He's busy. He's busy with Arianne, who also isn't making the show, apparently.
I just hope they're off somewhere having a lot of really hot sex.
Me too. Good for them. Someone should be.
Good for them.
After the sex.
So he's not thinking about Aerys Elkhart this way. Aerys Elkhart is, of course, a holdover from Robert's Kingsguard, I think the youngest of Robert's group. But it's funny because Aerys is, in fact, the one who is committing treason, I think, at about this very moment in Dorne. But the one he's not worried about. So after he has dealt with and then dismissed Baelon Swan, the only one left is Loras Tyrell.
Bring it.
And he talks to Loras a little bit about the, amazingness of him being appointed so young to the Kingsguard. I think Loras is still 17 at this point. Yeah, he is. Jaime says that. And Jaime's like, you're really young. And he's like, you're not as young as I was.
Yeah,
but
and he talks about how they're essentially having a cop comparison.
So competitive.
Yeah, they're so. Yeah, it is. It is basically a dick measuring contest. Yeah. Jamie actually calls it that.
He does. He says, "Yeah, they're comparing cocks or whatever it is." But that's. I guess it's another. This conversation is another reflection of how Jamie can change his tactics when dealing with people to try and get the best out of the exchange, because he does begin with this whole getting into it with Loras about who's the best and who was the youngest to be appointed. And then he tries a different tactic by starting to praise Loras because he realises that that will get him more than being more standoffish, I guess, and competitive. Well,
it's funny what brings him to that realisation is the fact that he realises that Loras is him. At that age.
Well, isn't he? I mean, that's what's happening here. This is... Yeah. Loras is here.
He's very harsh on himself in this chapter, isn't he?
He is. Yeah. In that he compares himself to Loras. I love Loras. Actually, I love Loras, and I love the Jamie and Loras interactions.
He's blaming himself, he's blaming himself for absolutely everything. I mean... He says he's the one who opened the door and you know, let the rats into the Kingsguard when he hasn't actually appointed any of them. And now he's saying what he sees of himself in Loras is the cocksure arrogance and empty chivalry, not the, you know, skill or anything, you know, particularly.
That's just, so true.
It's telling.
It really is. Oh, Jamie. How do people not love Jamie? I don't understand.
I don't know, Shiki, but they don't, and it's
sad. Oh, what's wrong with them? Anyway, so yeah, like you were talking about YD, he actually says it's like a sword fight. He's trying a different tactic, and he does go at Loras from a different direction, and he starts asking him about the Battle of the Blackwater, where they had a fake Renly. You know, who was it? We find out that it was Littlefinger's idea to do this fake Renly, and that Loras' brother Garland played the part.
Yeah.
And Jamie, after kind of buttering Loras up a little bit, kind of works into, okay, you know, it's really important that you defend Tommen, you know, and you see Loras taking that very seriously.
I find Loras's complete devotion to Renly here really touching. There's a nice little paragraph where he talks about burying Renly with his own hands and how he's going to make sure no one ever finds his body there to disturb his rest. And then, as you were saying, he does say to Jamie, you know, I will defend King Tommen. I'll give my life for his if need be, but I'll never betray Renly. I don't know. I found that really poignant. It made me like Loras a lot.
That's another interesting parallel with Jamie, isn't it? That Loras is actually very romantic, and it's a slightly taboo romance.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's very driven by love. We'll see that a lot of Loras in the next couple books, actually.
Loras really is Jamie. He really is a young kid. That's why he's in this series.
Yeah. And it's interesting how Jamie feels out his loyalty, and he's like, okay, is he still going to be loyal to Tommen? And Jamie judges that he will be, which is great.
Okay, so then, I just want to quickly mention that when Loras says about Renly, he's the king that should have been, he was the best of them, Jamie says the best things, the best dressed perhaps.
Yeah.
Oh, Jamie's thoughts in this chapter are hilarious.
They're all over the place and I love it.
I just like after that it says, but for once he did not say it, as if he's aware of his own tendency to say the wrong thing.
So then Jamie brings up Brienne to Loras, and he says, I still have her locked in a tower cell. And Loras immediately kind of shuts down, and all rapport is gone, and he's like, you know, she should be in a black cell, which is reserved for the greatest traitors. I think that's where Tyrion is a black cell. Jamie starts trying to talk Loras around.
Is that Jamie's actually using his logic and his intelligence to present the case for Brienne. He doesn't get angry. He does it very calmly. And you do see Loras start to come around to his way of thinking.
He really does. He builds a great case because he kind of presents to Loras, hey, you lost a king, you know. he kind of runs through this concept, and then he talks about himself, and he talks about how he felt when he killed Eris, and he's like, I promise you, I never grieve for Eris. And he talks about how Brienne grieves for Renly. And then it's amazing. He actually, you know, goes with Brienne's story about the shadow. And, you know, we kind of see maybe some doubts from Jamie in a later chapter, whether he for sure believes it, but he presents it as though he believes it to Loras.
What I also love is that Jaime essentially ends the conversation by telling Loras that he should go and question Brienne, because Jaime knows Brienne. He knows how guileless she appears and how honest she is, and he knows how badly she lacks a poker face. And I think it's evidence that he knows her so well. He knows her well enough to gauge how she's going to react to Loras' questioning and how her response will appear to him, and that it will prove her innocence to Loras. And not just that, I think it's also indicative of the way that he can read Loras and how Loras is coming around to his point of view, and how if Loras just spends a few minutes talking to Brienne, he will realise that she is in fact innocent.
He does, and it's a risk for him it to is send a risk. Loras Absolutely. To her. And you can see him, he actually says he makes that decision. So it's interesting, before Loras leaves, he turns back to Jaime and he says... some of the hardest things to hear for a Brienne fan, especially in retrospect once you've read Feast. I'll try to read this. He says to Jaime, Renly thought she was absurd, a woman dressed in man's mail, pretending to be a knight. And Jaime kind of tries to fob this off, and he goes, if he'd ever seen her in that pink dress, he wouldn't have complained. And Loras continues, and he said, I asked him why he kept her close, if he thought her so grotesque. He said that all his other knights wanted things of him, castles or honors or riches, but all that Brienne wanted was to die for him.
Yeah.
Oh, Brienne.
Yeah, that is devastating to hear.
It sums her up so well, though.
And we hear what Renly thought of her, that, you know, he thought she was absurd.
Yeah, he only wanted her close for what she could do for him. He didn't actually feel any sort of empathy or any even feelings of friendship or whatever. And it's obviously more devastating because of the way Brienne felt about him.
Yeah, and when you hear her point of view on him and how kind she thought he was, it's horrible.
It is, because she uprooted her life to follow this guy because she got the impression that he was kind to her. And I guess outwardly he was kind to her. But, I can't even imagine Brienne listening to what Renly thought about her, even though I guess her feelings start to change towards Jaime pretty quickly. But even so, that would be absolutely devastating to hear.
Yeah, it's kind of an inversion of her relationship with Jaime, really, isn't it?
Where it's all out in the open.
Yeah.
Except it's not. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
They do have that whole subtext going on, but Jaime does call it like he sees it with her as well.
Yeah. With Renly, it's all surface and is sort of the empty sort of courtesies. Whereas, Jaime is very honest and very blunt and quite... he can be quite demeaning towards her in terms of her looks and everything, but he is actually very honest with his...
I think the only reason Jamie's not honest about his feelings is because he's actually not aware of them.
But he does genuinely value her for her...
Absolutely.
For who she is. Yeah,
he does. And he does actually say as much, pretty much. I mean, he does tend to couch it with his snark.
An insult,
Yes, exactly. But you're right. It is it is a contrast for sure, the two relationships.
God, poor Brienne.
Oh, my baby.
Brienne. She deserves so much better than...
You know what she deserves, Chicky? The table.
I do. She deserves that table. So we close out the chapter with Jaime thinking about getting a golden hand, and he's like, but the hand could wait. He's like, there are other things to tend to first. There are other debts to pay, which is kind of a foreshadowing of his last chapter and Tyrion's as well. We did it, guys. We did two chapters.
We did it.
Wow.
We're way over time, but fuck it. We did it. So who has thank yous?
I have thank yous.
Eon, you have thank yous?
Yes.
Thankfully, we just have a couple this week.
We have a couple.
Good.
I wanted to bring out one thank you. A Chicky directed me to this one review on Stitcher, and we weren't sure who it was, but I'll give it to you. I'll give it to you. Here it is, okay? Because afterwards, we figured out who it was. But it says, great, listen, entertaining and insightful, full of spoilers. If you've read all of the books, you'll love this podcast. We found out it was our very own Lot. our moderator. All right. Our next one comes from Cynically Romantic. And she says, once again, the podcast was excellent, ladies. Kudos to Glam for stepping in. And I think every single Jamie Brienne fan has been preparing for this discussion since we all read The Bear Pit for the first time. And husbands of the podcast episode would surely be hysterical. Anyways, fabulous job as usual. And y'all are almost done with A Storm of Swords. Woohoo! What an achievement! Our last one is from Percula, and she says, hi, last podcast was fantastic as usual, and I have to say that it's so great to listen to all of your thoughts about Jamie and Brienne, and it's been a pure joy this summer. Thank you for an amazing work. Smiley face. Aww. And last but not least, I'd like to give a shout out to Maggie. Joker took my picture. She did awesome fan art comic strip of our 16th episode whenever Jamie's wanting to, he doesn't want to take the medicine. And
It was fantastic. We've actually reblogged that. We've reblogged it to the Close the Door and Come Here.tumblr.com blog. So if you want to check that out. And also, we should probably give Coralie a shout out for the Bear Pit reenactment that she did, which also is on our blog. So thank you, you guys. And also, thank you, Cynically Romantic. And who is the other thank you? Percula?
Percula.
Yes, thank you, guys. That's wonderful.
Awesome.
Yes.
Thanks, guys. And thanks to this week's guests.
Yay!
Oh, my God. Thank you. It is, probably daylight for Relly now. She's been up through the wee hours of the morning.
It's 4 a.m.
Are you going to go get some sleep now?
Probably not.
She's awake now.
Oh, no.
Thanks for being here, Rel. We loved having you. It's and a big problem. Thank you to Erin, Rose Papillon, for making it, whatever time it is for you, somewhere down under.
It's only 1 o'clock, but I have to take the day off work, but that's okay.
That's probably time to get yourself a Foster's and throw some shrimp on the bar.
Of course. What are you talking about? I started at 9 a.m.
Mate.
So many Australians on this podcast.
We need more Australians.
Hey, there's a North American minority on this podcast for the first time ever.
Right?
The Commonwealth finally wins!
Yay!
So did we say Jamie 9 is next week?
Yes.
The final chapter?
I hear that Jamie gives Brienne his sword next chapter.
He sure does.
She
Please
likes
tune
it.
In.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and all that.
What do you mean?
All right, thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.